Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. In 1965, Selma, Alabama became the epicenter of the civil rights movement. Thousands of activists, both black and white, came together from all over the country to end racial discrimination at the ballot box. Among them was Reverend James Reeb, who came to Selma from Boston, answering a call from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. for religious leaders to join the protests. During his time in Selma, Reverend Reeb was brutally beaten and eventually died from his injuries.
Three white men were arrested today in Selma, Alabama, on charges of assault with intent to murder three white ministers on a downtown street corner in Selma, Alabama, last night.
No one has ever been held accountable for his murder, and there are conflicting stories about what happened the night he was attacked. The three men who were arrested in connection to this case went on trial in 1965 and were acquitted by an all-white jury soon after. Now, Reeb's death was one of the catalysts that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But one major question remains. Who killed James Reeb? Andrew Beck Grace and Chip Brantley are the hosts of a new investigative podcast from NPR. It's called White Lies, and it looks to uncover the truth behind Reeb's murder. They join us now from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Andrew, Chip, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. So first, there are some folks in Boston who know about James Reeb. And according to the Boston Globe, some 25,000 people turned out on the Common for a vigil after his death. But for those who don't know his story, could you tell us a little bit more about him? Who was Reverend James Reeb and what do we know about what happened to him?
So, yeah, so this is Chip. James Reeb was a Unitarian minister. He'd been he lived in Philadelphia and then Washington, D.C. And in 1964, he was called to kind of a more social justice faith and decided to leave All Souls Unitarian Church in D.C. and move to Boston, where he worked for the American Friends Service Committee, and was really driven to, again, to become more engaged in his community. He moved to Dorchester, had really been turned on by there was a fire, a really horrible fire in 1964 down in that area. I believe it's called the Bellflower Street Fire. And so he really worked on housing issues and tried to become more engaged in his community. And like millions of other Americans in March 1965, saw footage from Bloody Sunday out of Selma when Alabama state troopers attacked peaceful demonstrators on the Ebbet Pettus Bridge, and was just moved to do something. And he was outraged when he saw the footage. And 2 days later, went to Selma along with many other Unitarians to show support for the marchers down there.
And what happened to him there?
Yeah, that's a good question. He arrived in Selma with a bunch of other ministers of all faith, really, came in to town on the Monday and Tuesday after Bloody Sunday. He arrived early Tuesday morning, and there was a march that was actually led by Dr. King that day. It's called Turnaround Tuesday because they get to the foot of the bridge where the protesters had been beaten, and then ultimately turn around as a show of solidarity, awaiting really the federal protection that would ultimately allow the successful Selma to Montgomery march to take place. So after Turnaround Tuesday, he's there at Brown Chapel AME Church, which was the sort of nerve center for the movement. He sees a lot of friends that he knows. He visits with people. And that evening, around 5 o'clock or so, he meets up with two other Unitarian ministers, Clark Olson and Orloff Miller, and they decide to go to dinner together. So they're walking they walk downtown, and they stop at a civil rights organization to ask where they should eat. And they are asked, would you like to eat with your own people or with African Americans, basically? And they say, well, we're here for solidarity, so we want to go to an African American restaurant. So they get sent to this place called Walker's Cafe. They have a dinner there. It's incredibly crowded with a totally mixed interracial crowd, which was a rarity for Selma at the time, especially for a black restaurant to have white patrons. And so they're there. They decide to leave to go back to hear Dr. King speak that night at Brown Chapel. And they decide to take what they think will be a quicker route back to the church, but going a different way than the way that they had originally come. They did not realize at the time that that route would take them by this place called the Silver Moon Cafe, which was a notoriously rough kind of segregationist bar. And so in front of that cafe, they're attacked by a group of men who yell racial slurs at them as they attack them. They're beat up. It's a very quick thing that happens there on the street. But one of those attackers swings a club at Reeb's head and hits him just devastatingly hard on the right at the temple of his head. And he falls to the ground. He's badly injured, kind of battling a little, but can sort of stand. And they walk him down the street back to the civil rights organization to get help, to get an ambulance to figure out what's going on with this injury. And that unleashes a sort of wave of different medical diagnoses at the early part of the night, and then they decide he has to go to Birmingham, which is about a 2-hour drive away. So they get an ambulance, and it's a complicated story from there. But that's ultimately what happens, and then he dies 2 days later in Birmingham.
It's Andrew, as you described there, that's truly a terrible thing that happened to James Reeb, and you know, this is sort of at the intersection of race in America at that time. And you know, you both grew up in Alabama. I should note you're both white, and I'm just curious if you felt a certain obligation to get the truth out of this story.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so this is, as you mentioned, Andy and I are both from Alabama. We were born in the generation after the civil rights movement proper, in the 70s. I'm a little bit older than Andy is. And, you know, so this is a story, of course, we in school and growing up here, we heard a lot about the events of the 1960s, but it is not something that I would say we talked about much in our communities, which is, as you mentioned, we're both white. So our white communities, we're not talking about the civil rights movement at all when we were growing up, except in the way that we all read about in textbooks in that time. And so I think, you know, for us, what was surprising when we first started to look into the story was that this, you know, as you mentioned, there were 25,000 people who protested, who marched in Boston for a vigil for Reeb after he died. The president invoked Reeb's death in a nationally televised speech before both houses of Congress. It was front page news for weeks. This is a huge story in 1965, and it's a name, James Reeb, that we had never heard before in our lives growing up in Alabama. That was surprising to us. And as we began to get into the story, we began to find out some reasons about why that name is not so well known.
And that, why is that?
Of course, being journalists. Well, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's curious. But here in the state of Alabama, especially in Selma where the attack took place, there was a trial. So the attack happened in March of 65. There was a trial in December of 65. And the three men who were tried were acquitted, which was, you know, you can, if you know anything about the civil rights era and the era of racial justice or lack thereof in the South, it's an unsurprising thing that an all-white jury, an all-male jury would acquit these folks. But when you
had to be registered to vote in order to serve on a jury, and you couldn't register to vote, right? I mean, you talk
about
that
in Dallas County. There were actually a handful of registered voters in Dallas County, African-American registered voters. But in neighboring Lowndes County, where the population was 80% black, there was a pretty legendary civil rights trial that happened there, and there wasn't a single black person called for the jury because there had never been a single black person that had been registered to vote in Lowndes County. But what happened in the trial is there was basically an argument presented at trial that these men didn't do the attack, which is a common argument for a trial. But the second argument was, even if they did do it, this man wasn't hurt badly enough in Selma for him to have died. And the civil rights movement had conspired either to delay medical treatment or to actually cause a further injury because they were in need of a white martyr. And that sounds shocking right now to hear that was a theory that was proposed, but it was a theory that was good enough to get those men off. And it was ultimately a theory that I think absolved so much. This is the argument that we sort of make in the show, that absolved white Southerners and white Selmians in particular of any responsibility of having to deal with the legacy of that violence. And honestly, I believe that's one of the reasons why that story is less known here in the state than it might be elsewhere, because for a certain number of people in the state, there was this sense that, oh, well, that's a more complicated story. That's not there, you know, something else might have happened there. So really the attempt of our show is to really try to understand and unpack how that story came to be and to eviscerate it and explain the ways in which it's a lie, essentially.
Well, I want to play a clip here from the podcast. It's a collection of voices of folks who are describing what they believe happened in 1965 to James Reeb.
Stories that were flying around.
Anything that happens, there's always a second story.
They say, oh, yeah, he really wasn't. It was the bad doctors or something like that.
Well, you know, did he hit his head on the pavement?
Slow ambulances to Birmingham.
I think they killed a man on the way to Birmingham. I'll always will believe it.
And a lot of the first episodes are about how something you believe is true can turn out to not be the entire truth. And that last voice, quote, they killed a man on the way to Birmingham, he's of course referencing this pernicious conspiracy theory that you were just describing, Andrew, around Reeb's death. Do you disprove that theory in your reporting?
Yes. Yes, we do. Don't want to give away too much that's coming, but yeah, I mean, this episode that actually came out today, episode 3, we really take that conspiracy theory, which has lived on in Selma through sort of a well-known propagandist in 65, really codified that conspiracy theory, and it still lives on. I mean, we can't tell you the number of times we have asked people about Jim Reeb and heard some version of that conspiracy theory.
And why do you think that conspiracy theory lives on?
Well, I mean, I think it's just never really been fully challenged. I mean, I think one of the things that was most intriguing to us about the story is the way in which the story, the sort of false story, the counter narrative of Reeb's attack and death, in so many ways mimics the way that white folks have been able to not deal with the sins of the past. We can create an easy and convenient story that was a long time ago and it's not connected to us and there's no legacy of any of this injustice, and it can absolve us from ever having to deal with the past. And in the Reeb case, it's a very specific injury, and you can actually see the genesis of this lie and you can understand the way it operates. But more collectively for all of us, it feels as though we all need a sort of reckoning with what does the past mean and what's the legacy of the past. So I think that's been one of the things that's been most interesting for us, is the way in which the story about Reeb is mimics so much of the things we don't want to address or be truthful about the past.
So you mentioned, and we talked about this a bit, but President Lyndon Johnson, of course, he invoked Reeb's murder in his speech introducing the Voting Rights Act. And in some ways, Reeb's death helped catalyze support for the act. I just want to play a bit of tape here from LBJ.
Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
Did it take a white man's death for this bill to pass?
I don't know. I mean, we've wrestled with this. I feel like it was just a perfect optics moment for Johnson. He was really concerned with what would happen to Reeb. I would say, maybe not ungenerously, he didn't necessarily care exactly what happened to Reeb, but knowing that the man was going to die presented this space for him to present to a more receptive nation at that moment this really radical, at the time, a radical bill to essentially change the course of American history, especially in the Deep South. Now that the question is, you know, did the deaths of African Americans before Reeb, did they contribute in many ways to Americans' coming awareness of racial injustice? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. It just so happens that Reeb's death happens at this moment when it's more visible and more present.
Yeah, I mean, the eyes of the nation are on Selma at that moment because of Bloody Sunday. So the timing was terrible, but it was taken advantage of.
Well, that's Chip Brantley and Andrew Beck Grace. They're the hosts of White Lies, a new NPR investigative podcast about the murder of Reverend James Reeb. We have a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. I wish we had more time, guys. This is a fascinating story and a fascinating podcast. Thanks so much.
No, thank you for your time.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.